On the program today, the great inventory dilemma of 22 continues. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday today, 8 June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, sometimes, like, today, we learn things about this economy from businesses sooner than we learn those same things from government indicators. Happens oftentimes, to be honest, but the instance at hand is inventories. How much stuff companies have in the storeroom waiting to sell. Savannah Marr told us about Target and its inventory-induced woes yesterday. You remember that? And lo and behold, today, the Census Bureau told us that inventories at the wholesale level were going up, too, back in March and April. That's big warehouses getting full of stuff. So, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore tells us what it all means.
The story of what to put on shelves has a lot of different versions in our economy right now. Here's one. Once upon a time, we were stuck inside, and we bought a bunch of stuff. And now we're free and spending our money on other things, and some stores are stuck with a bunch of stuff that nobody wants.
Some firms have simply misjudged the pullback of the consumer and are now facing unexpected or even unwelcome stockpile of goods.
Lindsay Piegza is chief economist at Stifel Financial. That is a story called Target.
Target doesn't want any more patio furniture.
Tim Quinlan is a senior economist with Wells Fargo. Another story goes like this. People don't like rising prices, so they try and find ways around them.
If beef prices are high, you shift your spending to chicken.
The name of that story is called Walmart, or Canceling Your Netflix. Stephen Bethel is seeing these stories firsthand. He works for Fraser Capital, which values companies.
Rising inventories are sort of an easy way to go bankrupt. The balance sheets that we're seeing are starting to show some of these issues.
But that is just some businesses. Other businesses are still telling an older story from the peak of the pandemic, which is they can't refill their shelves fast enough. They want more inventory. Again, Lindsay Piegza with Stifel.
We are seeing for some businesses a backlog of orders as supply chain disruptions are still lingering.
Yep, that is still happening. So the ultimate story of who is putting what on which shelf right now across our economy is chaotic. And that, in turn, is because our spending is also chaotic. Sure, some consumers are cutting back, but others are still spending a lot, especially on airfare and hotels, for example. So deciding what to put on the shelf and what will sell over the next few months isn't so much a story at all as a riddle. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Wall Street today kind of red. Not great, but not terrible. Details, numbers, y'all know the drill. We are going to do a story now about regulation. And before you reach to change the radio or flip to the next podcast in your queue or change your stream, hear me out, would you? Because we are talking here arguably about the future of money, in which I know we all have a vested interest. Cryptocurrencies are, not today, not tomorrow, but eventually, they're going to be actual usable money. And there's a fight brewing in Washington over how to regulate them, or more accurately, who should regulate them. Gary Gensler, who runs the Securities and Exchange Commission, says it ought to be the SEC because, his argument goes, crypto is kind of an awful lot like stocks, right? But a bill introduced in the Senate this week, the first real shot at regulating crypto, by the way, says the much smaller Commodity Futures Trading Commission ought to do it. And that also happens to be the preference of the crypto industry, too. Marketplace's Lily Jamali spent today looking into things.
The SEC and the CFTC regulate different things. True to its name, the Securities and Exchange Commission oversees securities.
Things like stocks and bonds. Those are things where there is an expectation of future profits from an investment of money in a common enterprise.
Georgetown Law's Adam Levitin says, on the other hand, the CFTC's main job is to regulate markets in commodities futures.
Making sure that the transactions are being done fairly without fraud or manipulation.
The pioneers of cryptocurrency were inspired by libertarian principles, but Levitin says crypto is now an industry and
at least part of it wants regulation. They want regulation because it has a legitimizing factor. But they don't want heavy-handed regulation, right? They want the benefits of regulation without the costs.
The SEC has more than 4,000 employees. The CFTC has only a few hundred. Its former chairman, Timothy Massid, says if the agency is going to be responsible for crypto, it's going to need more resources.
That would be a very, very big concern if it's not adequately funded. And frankly, history doesn't leave one optimistic.
In the aftermath of the 2008 financial crash, the CFTC was tasked with overseeing part of the mortgage-backed securities market, while its budget hardly changed.
That was a real problem for us. It really slowed us down and made it hard to do all the things we needed to do.
Meanwhile, some consumer advocates say Congress might do better by sitting this one out for now.
These agencies already have the authority they need to regulate this industry.
Mark Hayes is a senior policy analyst at Americans for Financial Reform.
Most of the cryptocurrency activity out there walks, talks, and acts like a security.
Which is why he believes the SEC should take the lead. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
For all the coverage of small businesses that we do on this program, and I mean us here at Marketplace, we don't have a fixed definition of what makes a business small. Sure, a literal mom-and-pop store is a small business, or a restaurant with a couple of dozen employees, sure. But what about a manufacturer with, say, I don't know, 150 people working there? I mean, maybe. But the federal government can't afford to be quite so loosey-goosey as we are, because there's federal aid earmarked just for small businesses. And also, because $150 billion worth of federal contracts are set aside for small businesses in this economy each and every year. The Fed's definition is based on what industry a business is in. 500 people makes for a very big restaurant, right? But a really small car company, so that's tricky. Also, the number of people that business employs and how much revenue it pulls in every year. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, the government has started playing around with that definition lately.
The last couple of years have been pretty good at Akana, a small engineering firm based in Portland, Oregon.
During the pandemic, we were able to win some large federal contracts.
That's Herb Fricke, Akana's president and CEO. He says those contracts have included road work, light rail construction, new bridges.
And we increased our revenue significantly.
Fricke says the federal government is now the company's biggest client. And he's hoping Akana can get a piece of the $1 trillion in infrastructure spending President Biden signed off on last November.
Now, there's still a lot of temptation to continue growing. You have to make hay when the sun is shining, right?
Problem is, business has almost been too good for Akana. Until this year, the federal government's definition of a small engineering firm was one that brought in an average of no more than $16.5 million a year in revenue. And last year, Akana brought in more than that. Its status as a small business was at risk.
If we weren't designated small business, we'd be competing with the gigantic companies out there.
In April, the Small Business Administration increased the maximum size standard for small engineering firms by $6 million a year. Fricke says that gives his company room to grow.
Yeah, well, I was concerned 2 months ago. And then when they brought out the new standard, you know, I took a sigh of relief.
The SBA is required to revise its size standards every 5 years. The idea is to keep firms from having to worry about losing their small business designation, the way that Herb Fricke did.
So we don't want to artificially keep them at a lower level. We want to be able to create that pathway for growth.
That's Bibi Hidalgo, the SBA's Associate Administrator for Government Contracting and Business Development. She says the SBA's new size standards in 229 sectors won't just help current government contractors like Akana. It'll also allow new companies to start competing for government contracts and aid.
It's basically making our programs accessible to close to 60,000 additional firms across the United States.
But raising the threshold of how big a small business can be runs the risk of including some businesses that aren't small at all, says Karen Kerrigan, CEO of the Small Business Council.
And the whole point of the set-asides was just to allow more small businesses to have the opportunity to compete against the bigger businesses for contracts. So if you're making these size standards larger, I mean, they could lose meaning.
The biggest small businesses could end up with a huge advantage over the smallest companies.
Let's say a firm like mine, the likelihood that we actually get awarded is significantly small, but now it's going to be even harder to get that.
That's Ray Mendes, president of Mendes Engineering in San Antonio. His firm brings in roughly $2 million a year. That's well below the $22.5 million threshold for small engineering firms. In order to win government contracts, Mendes has been looking to partner up with bigger firms.
You know, if you can get a good teaming partner, you can both capitalize it because that's, you have more contract opportunities to pursue that way because you're a team and you go in as one.
Teaming up gives small firms like his something that they don't have.
The reason that a lot of these smaller firms get teamed up with is because a lot of times they don't know the way or who to approach or how to win these contracts. And the bigger firms that have done this for years, they have a good roadmap to do that.
The goal, Mendes says, is to leverage those partnerships so that one day his company can be the bigger engineering firm. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Businesses are out to make money.
Well, yes. Yes, they are. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials, down 269. Today, 0.8%, 32,910. The NASDAQ gave back 88 points, about 0.75%, 12,086. S&P 500 lost 44 points, 1%, 41.15. Target, which, as we know now, is dealing with excess inventory, gained 0.4% today, despite a downgrade from Bank of America. Stock trading firm Robinhood dropped 3.9% today after the aforementioned chair of the SEC, Gary Gensler, outlined potential changes in the rules around trades. Charles Schwab off about 2.6% today. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year T-note. Here comes 3.02%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Our coverage of the murders in Uvalde a couple of weeks ago, 19 kids and two of their teachers, is premised on this reality, that guns in this country are an economic story, a multi-billion dollar industrial story. And it's not just the guns themselves, it's the downstream effects of those guns, too, one of which is the very lucrative business of school security, hardening the targets, training teachers and kids, active shooter drills. Those are businesses about which Mark Kierlieber wrote in the 74 the other day. That's a K-12 education news site. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You point out in this piece that school security has been a thing, obviously, for decades. But this idea of school hardening really took off after Columbine. Could you explain what changed in the school security field?
Yeah, absolutely. So after Columbine, a lot of, emphasis has really went into different types of technology going into schools, different types of security measures, like police officers in schools. And, in the wake of Columbine, very few school districts, for example, had security cameras that were monitoring, the hallways or the outsides of the schools. Well, today that's pretty much universal, right? We're seeing school districts all across the country with cameras. And, that's just one small slice of what has become, nearly a $3 billion industry that includes access control, fencing, everything from, bulletproof backpacks up to security cameras with facial recognition technology.
Part of the product offering, if you will, goes beyond just hardening of the school sites, right? They do they help conduct active shooter drills. They conduct training in schools, and certainly since Uvalde, but for a while it's been known that these drills can be excessive. They can be traumatizing for the children. They can be exhausting for the teachers and the staff. And yet the schools kind of continue, as you say in this piece, to have to buy them.
Yeah, I mean, there's this this reality that school districts and lawmakers face in the aftermath of shootings, which is they have to do something, yeah. right? So there's this big tragedy that's scaring everybody, frankly, despite, you know, the statistical rarity of such events. And school leaders and lawmakers are put in a position to implement something that they hope will, you know, cause, you know, additional safety, will give parents a peace of mind. And you know, the rush to harden schools is certainly one of the primary strategies that we've seen in the past and that we're certainly going to see, you know, here in the next couple of months.
Can we talk cost for a second? And I ask because my local school district, and look, we're in a well-off suburb of Los Angeles. We just had to pass a special mm-hmm. bond to get part of the money is going for school security, fencing, and all those kinds of things. And I'm here to tell you that not every school district in the country can do that, but also not every state capital is going to say, here's, you know, I think the quote in your piece is like $500,000 for every high school to do this. Where is this money coming from?
Yeah, well, like you mentioned, it does come from the local level. There are bond referendums in you know, municipalities. There have been, you know, laws at the state level that actually require schools to have certain measures in place. And then there is significant federal money. You know, in the wake of the Parkland shooting, the security companies successfully lobbied, you know, the federal government to pass the Stop School Violence Act, which appropriated, you know, millions of dollars mm-hmm. for school districts across the country to implement different forms of school security. And we're actually, it appears like we're going to be in a similar situation, you know, in the wake of the shooting in Texas.
Well, so along those lines, let me just close with this. There is no small portion of the audience of this radio program, whether they hear it on the air or on demand, it's millions of people. They will say to me, on Twitter or in the inbox or whatever, do you understand how insane it is to be talking about spending billions of dollars to harden these targets, right, schools, mm-hmm. and not be able to do anything about the fundamental problem? And I guess I ask you as a guy who has written and thought about this, what do you say to that?
Well, I do think that's, you know, that's part of the issue here, right? So the heart of the problem is guns, right? And access to guns. And the reality of the situation is that this is a very central debate in America. And gun control has long been something that has been debated, but it hasn't come to fruition. So schools are, you know, saying, you know, that might not happen, but let's figure out what we can do, right? And looking at the, you know, maybe something that might be proactive, but instead of, you know, looking at a proactive solution, we're looking at, you know, a reactive solution.
Mark Heilaber, he's a reporter at the 74. They cover K through 12 education stuff. Mark, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time and your reporting.
Thank you.
More COVID vaccines may be coming soon to a pharmacy near you. Just yesterday, an FDA panel recommended the agency authorize Novavax's two-dose vaccine. It's more like traditional vaccines, you might have heard this, than the mRNA offerings from Pfizer and Moderna. And Moderna says its updated mRNA booster gives better protection against the Omicron variant. But we are 2+ years into this thing, and not to be all businessy about it, but is there still really a market for new vaccines? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
Let's start with a little vaccination update. Only 2/3 of Americans have gotten 2 COVID shots. So William Schaffner, a professor of infectious diseases at Vanderbilt University, says there's an opportunity for Novavax.
Using traditional technology may reassure some people who had some skepticism about vaccine.
Traditional technology. It's a little in the weeds sciencey to explain, but the Novavax vaccine is made the way most vaccines are, using the virus's protein. Schaffner thinks this could help establish more trust. And Hartaj Singh, a biotech analyst at Oppenheimer, says more options equals more trust, because competition can signal quality.
Greater choice is always better than less.
And vaccine makers recognize that we'll likely be making a choice about COVID shots for a long time as the virus potentially becomes endemic. Mayank Mamtani is a biotech analyst at B. Riley Securities.
From a financial investment standpoint, the boosting becomes very important.
As does vaccine innovation. Novavax, for instance, is currently developing a vaccine that combines the flu and COVID shot in one, which could drive sales.
You know, you just have to have high volumes and you have to really have that big global commercial muscle to drive that volume.
Of course, sales do depend on whether companies can persuade people to keep rolling up their sleeves as new variants pop up. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
With the understanding that correlation is not causality, spending on dietary supplements saw some growth during the pandemic. Caleb Radel of the Mountain West News Bureau in Reno, Nevada, did some looking into that one.
At Now Foods Factory in Northern Nevada, the manufacturer of natural health products is pumping out bottles of dietary supplements, from vitamin A soft gels to zinc tablets. Eric Maupin is the processing supervisor at Now's 130,000-square-foot facility in Sparks. He's standing near a car-sized drying tumbler that's blending powders for vitamin D3 supplements and says it's one of the newer machines.
This unit will produce about 2 million soft gels during this shift.
Those 2 million soft gels will help the company meet increased demand. Since COVID-19 hit, the company says its supplement sales have surged nearly 20%. Jim Emmy is the Illinois-based company's CEO. He says more people are looking for ways to improve their health and well-being.
Even if they hadn't been exposed to COVID, they were trying to do whatever they could to help their immunity system build up.
That's also helped startups like Reno-based OK Capsule. It has a technology platform that pairs with companies' e-commerce stores. That allows brands to sell personalized supplement packets that OK Capsule sorts, packs, and ships. CEO Andrew Brandeis says the company's revenue grew 25% last year compared to 2020. In March, the company announced it had raised $9.5 million from investors.
Right now, we're having a great convergence of technology and wellness that just kind of hasn't happened before.
The fastest selling supplements have been vitamins C and D and zinc. But the people who benefit from taking supplements mainly have very low or deficient levels, says Jessica Blauenstein, a registered dietitian in Reno. She says strengthening your immune system starts with what you put on your plate.
Food first is a great philosophy to discuss, mainly because we get a lot more from foods than we can a supplement.
Still, U.S. consumers are spending more on supplements than ever before. Blauenstein says most adults take them without a doctor's recommendation. Then came the pandemic, which led to supplement brands making false COVID-related claims. The Food and Drug Administration has sent dozens of warning letters to companies throughout the pandemic. Laura Crosswell is an associate professor of health communication at the University of Nevada, Reno. Her research focuses on persuasive messages related to health marketing.
There was opportunity for that industry to capitalize on people's fear. We live in a capitalist society and businesses are out to make money.
To be clear, OK Capsule and Now Foods are not among the companies that received letters from the FDA. And Crosswell says companies typically don't try to deceive their customers in the age of social media and internet watchdogs, but they do use social media to promote their products.
I think influencers are huge. Today, more and more often, consumers trust influencers more than companies themselves and the ads they send out.
And those influencers are helping to drive sales. The supplement business is now nearly a $36 billion a year industry. In Reno, I'm Caleb Bradle for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, I saw this morning on CNBC that Michigan is set to become the 14th state to make a personal finance course a requirement for high school graduation, which, and yes, I suppose I'm biased, right, given what I do for a living, does seem like a great idea to me. But also, 36 states don't have that as a requirement. All right, we're going, but here's your moment of economic context. It comes to us today from the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, which does an unofficial gross domestic product indicator called GDP Now. It's kind of a real-time estimate of where the economy is at now, right? Anyway, the Atlanta Fed has second quarter GDP, and we are in the last month of Q2 right now. The Atlanta Fed says Q2 GDP growth is going to be 0.9%. I guess we'll check back. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.